Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
On the last episode of Guilt.
There is nothing that would say that somebody would be going to a meeting before they have been accepted, because that would not happen.
It's possible maybe Jim might have seen joining the Freemasons as a way to kind of get ahead at work.
Well, that's, if there is, I'm not aware of that. But if there is, he could well have thought that was a good idea, yes.
It's violence that may disturb some people.
Today we can officially announce that New Zealand Steel has cracked the code.
On the 21st of June 2004, scientist Jim Donnelly vanished from his work at the Glenbrook Steel.
From Brevity Studios in New Zealand, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt.
Nothing in the early days to indicate that we were looking for somebody who had been any misadventure.
You're on hands and knees, and you don't know what you're going to find. It started off as a joke, and then it got rather scary.
I just asked if anybody out there has any information that can help me put this victim home.
Before we get started in this episode, I just want to remind you about our Brevity Plus subscription. For a small monthly fee or a discounted yearly fee, you can get early access. Every episode is available ad-free and a week early for subscribers. Plus, you'll have access to bonus content. I always try to include as much of the key interviews as possible, so you have all the relevant information to form your own opinion. But oftentimes, there just isn't enough time to include everything. Subscribers have access to extra bonus episodes, which include extended interviews with important witnesses, some up to 2 hours long. We often get messages from subscribers related to this bonus material, as there can be more insight to be gleaned. There will also be a standalone episode of this season titled Hearsay that will be released in the next couple weeks, which will cover some largely unknown but interesting theories regarding Jim's disappearance. This episode will be available only to subscribers. And if you really love this content and how it's put together, then you're really going to love some of the other brand new true crime podcasts Brevity Studios will be releasing this year and in the future. Brevity Plus subscribers will have exclusive early access to these new podcasts. And of course, by subscribing, you'll be greatly helping make this an upcoming podcast possible. It's because of you that I'm able to make all of this happen, and thank you so much for that. Apple users can subscribe via the Apple app, and non-Apple users can subscribe via Acast Plus. You'll find the link in the description of every episode. Okay, now that's enough promo for me. This episode is, in my opinion, possibly the most important one yet. So let's get into it. When I started this podcast, I came into it with no bias whatsoever. And I think that's always been one of my strengths in life. I tend to have the ability to look at any given situation objectively and logically and not be influenced by rumor or hysteria. Just the facts. As you'll be aware, one of my favorite principles of theory is Occam's razor, which basically means that when analyzing a given problem, the solution that is constructed with the smallest number of possible elements tends to be the correct one. We can simplify this further to say, more or less, it's the most logical solution, or the simplest one, that will most times be correct. If there was ever a case that required a clear head and sound reasoning, the case of Jim Donnelly's disappearance is it. As we move into these final few episodes, I want you to try and clear your head, step outside the case, and look at all the events that took place, and really think, are these all as disconnected and crazy as they look? Or is there some sense here? Because I believe the solution may be right there, if you know where to look.
I was a team leader for New Zealand Steel in the rolling mills, and I had a lot to do with Jim in terms of my professional time there, because he was my production engineer, or what you call process engineer.
My goal when I started this podcast was to speak to every person that saw Jim that final morning before he disappeared, or has any relevant evidence to add. I've spoken to every one of these people throughout this podcast, and almost without fail, they've been able to shine more of a light on what actually took place. But there's one key person I haven't been able to track down. Finally, only recently, I was able to make contact with one of the last people to see Jim alive. His name is Stephen Morris. He's long since retired from the mill, but he can vividly recall the events of that day. As it turns out, they've weighed heavily on his mind for the last 18 years. Stephen and Jim worked closely together for many years and got to know Jim both professionally and to a degree personally.
So, yeah, I did have a bit to do with Jim, and probably on a more personal basis. Jim used to come in on the weekends, and not every weekend, but sometimes on a Saturday. And if I was on shift, I'd sit with him in his office and discuss, obviously, work, and sometimes we'd discuss personal stuff.
Okay, well.
But it was definitely more professional.
Yeah. Okay, and how many years would you say roughly you worked with Jim for?
Yeah, I guess it would have been a few years.
Okay, yeah, okay. So long enough that you sort of got to know him well enough, sort of.
I definitely think I formed an opinion of Jim, yes.
Yeah. Why don't you tell me sort of what would that sort of opinion be? I mean, tell me about how the Jim that you knew.
The Jim that I perceived that I knew was very professional. He was he could be very one dimensional in his approach. He appeared to be a very bright man. My relationship with him professionally, in terms of what we had to do with my New Zealand Steel side, he was always very good at what he did, very thorough. He probably, maybe, if I could use the term, I don't think it was upset, but maybe he just he could get under people's skin a little bit because he was so probably pedantic in his approach to his work. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
He was never nasty with it or anything like that. He was just Jim. So on the professional side of things, in terms of my work with him, he was always Jim. And then when I had the time when I sat with him in his office and he talked about golf, my memory's a little bit hazy, but I'm pretty certain he was really, really very, very into his golf. And he, at his desk, this is what this is what I always remember about Jim. At his desk, he had his pictures of his kids, and we talked family stuff. And he loved his kids. From what I could make out, he was, you know, a family man. We never really discussed our wives because that just wasn't really our relationship in terms of our if it was a call to friendship. But I know that he loved his kids.
Do you remember any change in behaviour in those like weeks leading up to when he disappeared in particular? Or
well, I did know that, and I can't honestly remember what we're working on because it is a long time ago. But I think there was a bit of pressure put on him to provide some answers on a certain part of the process, if I can remember correctly. I could be wrong, but I do think that was the case. And he did seem, if I could say the word, probably a little bit agitated. There was probably a bit of pressure put on him by the management. But when I say pressure, I mean, you know, it was just that was what we did. You know, we worked and we had to provide answers and solutions and get the job done, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'd imagine so, it's sort of a high stress, you know, it's just the nature of the job.
It is the nature of the job. And when you throw shift work into it and, you know, it can become, things can become a bit stressful, you know. And at that time, the mill was running, if I remember correctly, the mill was running quite well in terms of, you know, we were pumping steel out. And I think we had, you know, so we sort of couldn't muck around, if you know what I mean. And we had to find answers. And quite often, you know, on the run, they were expecting answers almost straight away.
There's that word that's been used to describe Jim's behaviour in the weeks immediately prior to his disappearance. Agitated. As you can imagine, working at a place like NZ Steel is going to be a relatively high-stress environment. I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars of steel being produced every day. And if there's any problem with this process, the production is going to be affected. In these weeks, it seems that the pressure on Jim had been ramped up beyond what would normally be expected. When Tracy said she came home from overseas to a person who seemed distracted, I think it's very reasonable to make the connection that this extra pressure at work could have been contributing to this. Jim was normally able to mentally leave his work at work, but it's possible that during this time, it weighed on him heavily. I asked Stephen to take me back to the last time he saw Jim. A fleeting moment, but crucial in our understanding of Jim's frame of mind that morning. What you remember, just talk me through the last time, you know, that sort of meeting you had with Jim.
Okay. It was almost split second, to be truthful.
Yeah.
I was coming off shift. I think it was probably around about 7 o'clock in the morning, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
I walked out of my team leader's office. I'd just done a handover. I walked out of the team leader's office, and we have stairs from the we're on the second floor. We have stairs from obviously below coming up onto the second floor because Jim's office was next to my team leader's office. I walked out, probably took two steps, looked, and there was Jim coming up the stairs, and I always remember he looked dishevelled. He looked just for that split second. That's on reflection. He looked like, you know, when you are just about to do something and then you remember something and you're like, you're going to walk backwards. It was like he almost didn't want me to see him. So much has been said about that event, and I've thought it over a million times, but definitely there was something that was not right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. So he's walking up just sort of when you're kind of just seeing each other. He suddenly turns and walks back the other way.
Well, no, he didn't, because what happened was as he sort of went to step, he stopped, looked at me, and I said, "Good morning, Jim." And I honestly can't remember whether he said anything, because the team leader that I just handed over yelled out, "Hey, Steve!" And so I actually spun around and went back into the office. and then that was the last I saw of Jim. So whether he came up the steps and walked past the office, I do not know, or whether he went back down, I do not know.
But that moment in time,
he was about two steps off the top of coming up onto the second story.
Okay.
Or floor.
And you're saying, like, as he was walking, he sort of paused just at that moment.
He paused.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a strange pause, though. Because normally if I'd have met Jim, he would have just kept, you know, to me, that's what always sticks in my mind, is that, you know, he would have just kept walking. There was no reason. But it was like he was trying to avoid me. When I think back on it, you know, obviously with all the history of him disappearing, it definitely struck me as he was, he didn't want to be seen.
Yeah.
That was the impression that I got now.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, you know that Anthony Karkow described a very similar thing. You know, where he said...
Tony Karkow.
Yeah, I mean, he said the same thing. I can't remember exactly where he was, near the Forehigh, and Jim came round, and then, you know, at the time, I guess that they sort of saw each other, suddenly Jim turned like as if he didn't know where he was going, and then went off in a different direction.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly like... Yes, that's exactly how I perceived it, as a sort of a... Yeah, definitely something very different out of Jim's normal way he would been approached.
Yeah, I mean, would you use the word sort of evasive? You know, he's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
But only evasive as the fact that he was, like, he was out in the open and he couldn't go anywhere. Like, he couldn't step behind anything to be avoided. He was there and... You know what I mean? Caught in time, caught in that moment there on the step.
Yeah, nowhere to go.
Nowhere to go.
I'm going to highlight a key word here, evasive, because this is exactly how Jim's actions have been described by multiple people that saw him that morning. Let's quickly go over these sightings. Just after 6 a.m., a mill employee heading to the toilet walks past Jim standing at his locker in jeans with no shirt on. As the employee walks past, Jim shifts in a way to shield his locker. The employee goes to the toilet, which he says took 2 to 3 minutes. When he walks back past, Jim is still standing in the same position. He hasn't continued to get dressed and again shields his locker. Shortly after this, Jim is sighted by Stephen Morris in the events we've just covered. Jim pauses in the middle of his step, as if he doesn't want to be seen. In Stephen's words, caught, with nowhere to go. Around the same time, Jim is sighted by Anthony Karkow. He states that he saw Jim walk towards the offices. He went to go into the Six Eye, then changed his mind and turned and walked to the Pickle Line side of the building. The next time Jim is seen by Dean Forsman at 8:30 a.m, Jim is now wearing a different jacket, an orange swan dry type, and is seen walking in the area between the Six High and the Four High. I've since learned more about Anthony Karkow's sighting, and he was able to clarify that he didn't think Jim saw him, so Jim's odd changing of direction couldn't be described as evasive here. But it clearly shows that he was between two minds about something. But the last direction he was seen walking was towards the Pickle Line side of the building. Stephen's statement about Jim's behaviour is, for me, the missing piece I needed to confirm that indeed Jim was acting evasively that morning. For some reason, he was trying to hide A, something in his locker, and B, himself or what he was doing. Jim was up to something that morning. The same morning, he would disappear without a trace. Stephen and I continue to talk, and he makes a point of saying that he thinks it would be very unlikely the helmet could have been missed in the search. So around in circles, we go on that. I think we'll never have a definitive answer on the helmet and when it was placed. So both options will need to be taken into consideration.
I explained to Stephen about the discovery that Jim's entire jacket appears to have gone into the acid bath. And eventually, we discuss Dean Forsman's sighting at 8:30 a.m. and the fact that in this sighting, there is one key difference to the others. Jim is now wearing a different jacket.
The orange jacket that I think that Dean has said is actually like a Swanbrook jacket. You know, it's a Swanbrook jacket, but it's all orange.
Mm, that's what he described it as.
Swanbrook jacket. And, you know, Jim may have, he may have been issued. I don't know. You could probably check the records now, but obviously, we were issued with different uniforms and, or different parts of the uniform. And quite often, in the winter, the guys would be issued with a Swandry jacket.
Yeah.
An orange Swandry jacket. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if Jim had one of those in his locker.
Yeah.
Not surprised at all.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I don't have the list of Jim's issued uniform, and I'm not likely to be given it by NZ Steel. But multiple people I've spoken to from that time said these jackets were issued to everyone at the mill over a period of months, so it's quite possible he had one in his locker. But either way, given Jim's evasive behaviour that morning, we have to consider, could it have been this Swandry jacket Jim was concealing when he was getting changed at his locker? If Jim had himself placed his other NZ Steel jacket in the acid, and this was planned, then it would have been necessary to have another jacket, perhaps concealed underneath. Which is why he waited for the employee in the locker room to go to the toilet and back before continuing to get changed. I'm speculating here, but given Jim's behaviour, the discovery of the remains of Jim's other jacket in the acid, and then this final sighting of Jim wearing a different jacket, I think it's reasonable to conclude these things could be connected. We then move on to discuss Jim's pants being found. And Stephen adds some interesting insight here. Did you hear about his pants that were found in the steel mill laundry?
Yes.
Yeah.
I heard that on the podcast, which I thought was in the steel mill, but Jim came from that part of the world in the beginning. So, I mean, he would have had a good idea of, you know, where and how and why in that plant. So he could have. Yeah, it just another thing to look at.
Oh, so that's it. So he did used to work in the steel plant.
I believe so, yes.
Just a small detail, but an important one. As I've said before, NZ Steel is a huge place, made up of different plants, like the rolling mills plant and the steel plant. Each of these need their own map, they're so large. And if you didn't know your way around another plant, it certainly wouldn't be as easy to locate something like, for example, the laundry. As he formerly worked in the steel plant, Jim would have been well aware of the layout and where the laundry would have been if it was indeed him that changed his cow shit covered pants here, as I believe he did. Stephen goes on to tell me about his thoughts on foul play before he asks me a question, which I'm very interested in, and not for the first time.
I personally think, on the record, off the record, or whatever you'd like to do, but yeah. I don't think anyone's bopped Jim on the head. I just don't see anyone. I don't know the guy down the road that is if I hate to say this, you know, is a murderer. I don't know, but I don't think anyone at the mill is, to me, was ever seemed that they would do anything untoward to Jim. You know.
Yeah.
They might have told him that he was a blah, 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 but that was probably about as worse as it could have probably got. Mm. But certainly nothing physical. So,
yeah.
Hey, one thing, Ryan, and there again, this is on the record, off the record, whatever, but, did anyone ever say about the trains? Well, the only thing is that I have obviously contemplated it a lot, and the thing that I have always thought is that, Jim could have just gone under a tarp on a coil, and that would have been the way he could have got out of the mill unseen, to me.
Yeah. Tell me about where the trains used to come up in the rolling mills.
Well, we had two or three different platforms where the trains came in. One very close to Jim's office, and one a little bit away from Jim's office. So to me, he basically walked down by a train to get to his office all the time.
Like every day kind of thing.
Pretty much every day. Because we used to load coils on at night and load coils during the day. It was pretty much a 24 hours operation, so we'd, depending on when the trains came in, but we'd load coils and we'd put tarps on them, and then towards the end we got away from that and we actually had carriages that had like containers with sliding doors on them. We'd shut them. So, and Jim would know that process off by, he would have known how to operate it. It wasn't hard. So I always thought that, Jim could have, he could have jumped on the train and disappeared. It would have been, he could have hidden under a tarp for a few hours, because I believe that the sort of timeline is that he wasn't actually being looked for until later in the day.
Yeah.
So, he could have gone in there in the morning, even after I'd seen him, he could have gone and hidden under a tarp and disappeared.
Mm. Yeah.
That's just a thought that I've had about how he could have got out without being seen.
Yeah, it's funny that Mark Olson said the exact same thing. He said, there was one obvious thing that he felt had never been looked at, and that was this train that, Jim would have seen it. It was like 20 yards from his office every day. It's kind of like with a beacon on it saying, hey, jump on me if you want to get out of here.
Oh, for real. I often had just a crazy thought, but I thought, you could hide under the tarp if you really wanted to and disappear. It's just that sort of, you have those stupid, a stupid thought, but so that's always to me is because he wasn't seen, and that's another thing about the mill. There are a lot of people around and there are a lot of people not around, but to actually not be seen I guess everything has to fall into place. You know what I'm saying, Ryan?
Yeah.
Everything has to fall into place to just disappear.
Hmm.
And how often does that happen in a plan?
Yeah.
If does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally.
You know what I'm
yeah.
saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even the best laid plans, someone comes out of the toilet. They've had a dodgy curry or something and they shouldn't be there, but they were there.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it was like you hadn't planned for that, but it happened. So I've often thought for him to just disappear, everything has to just be so spot on.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought about the train. It's just that he could have disappeared on the train quite easily.
It's especially at night, because I've spoken to train people and they said that they actually got me the timeline, the plan of the hours the train used to leave back at that time. And there was a train that left at 10:30 at night. But, because I've been told by a lot of people that at night the mill is skeleton staff, and if you know where to move, you could move around without being seen.
Definitely at night, definitely.
Yeah, and so...
And, sorry, Ryan, to interrupt you. That missing in the morning, to me, it's just like he must have... If he had somewhere where he knew he could probably hide until... or disappear until night would make sense.
Yeah.
Or jump on the train in the morning if there was a morning train. I can't remember, to be correct, to be truthful. But, you know, definitely at night. And people move around at night and you're a lot more invisible.
Yeah.
At night.
Stephen is exactly right when he says that everything has to go perfectly for someone to just disappear. Whether that's foul play and people avoiding being detected, or that's Jim himself, perhaps hiding, then jumping on a train. It's clear that whichever option it was, worked perfectly. So I guess when we're looking at this, we need to consider what's more likely. If we apply Occam's razor here, which option has the least number of elements? In the last episode, I spoke about a man that was apparently not happy in his job. Someone that appeared to be desperate to improve his situation. The next thing Stephen was about to tell me was, to be honest, something that deeply saddened me and still does to this day. I've included this because I believe it can provide some further insight and context as to Jim's mental state during this period of time. I'll add that Stephen was a bit torn as to whether he should say this, and I asked if he wanted this on the record. He paused, but said that anything he can add that might provide further clarity to this case and possibly bring a final solution, he felt should be shared.
You know, the mill was an arsehole of a place to work for some people, to tell you the truth. I have a lot of respect for a lot of people that work there, but I have no respect for some of the people that work there. It was a bullying place. And if I can say this, and hopefully, you know, I probably have to be careful what I say, but there were a couple of people that probably gave Jim a very hard time. And upper management probably didn't think a lot of him, and probably abused their powers. And I know that they put a lot of pressure on Jim. Towards the end there, I know that there was a lot of pressure put on him. Not so much me, but Jim, and the people that were sort of in charge of the process, the management at that time, not so much the team leaders, but the next line up, they did give him a hard time. They did think it was a bit of a bullying culture.
Was he a bit of an easy target just because he was a bit socially, you know?
I think so. I don't want to make Jim look like a. You know, he was a. I mean, Jim was Jim, and you know, we're all different. But he was very studious, very honest, I think, very capable man. But he was under a lot of pressure, and some of these people put a lot more pressure on him. And as I say, I think it was. I think to me, it got to the stage where he's almost being bullied.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? You know, imagine you've got that work culture at work, you go home and things are not great at home. I know that Tracy said that he actually wanted to get a job somewhere else, but Tracy wouldn't let him because she didn't want to move. So,
right.
So, man, you're in a hopeless situation, you know?
Yeah.
And you, that's the thing. I mean, at what point do you have to get to before you do make that decision that, right, like, I need to do something drastic?
Well, I think, you know, there again, what you use is up to you, but just for my perspective is that I do think that it doesn't surprise me that he disappeared, how he disappeared and why and all, yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's not a surprise. It's always something that's been with me, but I do know that he was, my opinion, my impression was that he was being bullied.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can... As I said, it was a like bloody boarding school. It was, a lot of crap that went on, man. You know, there was a lot of money involved. People were earning money. You know, it was a very... It's quite a strange place to work.
Like boarding school. This point struck a note with me. I went to boarding school, and I know exactly what can happen in that kind of environment to people that struggle to fit in, people that are easy targets. I've witnessed firsthand the type of bullying that can take place and seen the immense psychological damage it can have on a person. But if it's anything like boarding school, then times have changed. Boarding school today is nothing like it was 20 years ago. And to be clear, my understanding is that there have been huge shifts in the operation of NZ Steel also. I don't believe this type of behaviour is existent or condoned today. But 20 years ago, the world, like NZ Steel, was a very different place.
Like, yeah, it was just a giant clusterfuck at times, excuse me.
Yeah.
Jim was, he was under a lot of pressure. He was under a lot of pressure.
Mm.
And now when I understand that, you know, things weren't great at home, it sort of makes a little bit more sense after all these years. It's actually been quite a bit of a comfort to me that you've sort of delved into it, and I've sort of looked at it again, because to tell you the truth, it has affected me in a different sort of a way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing is, I've just found it, you know, it's sad. I just sort of think, what was the poor guy going through, you know?
Yeah, and that's what I feel very... I felt very upset for a long time that, you know, I didn't really do anything about it.
You're doing something now, so...
You know something, Ryan, I'm just over the moon that I've come to this time in my life where I can almost put this behind me now. Because to tell you the truth, Ryan, it's bugged me. And every time something happens and someone says something about Jim, my heart skips a beat, because it has had an effect on me. It's absolutely really strange, and I just don't know why, but it's always made me feel so bad.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can understand that. It's nice to hear that, you know, in a way, like that someone sort of, you know, actually did care, sort of thing.
I did care for Jim, yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, I cared for everyone, actually.
you sound like one of those guys.
I just see the good in people. And Jim had a lot of good in him. He did have a lot of good in him.
Dealing with this material, day in and day out, is incredibly draining and often emotionally very difficult. I find myself regularly at the end of a day of writing or interviews with a drink in my hand, sitting in silence, trying to process everything. Often there's so much negative, it can be hard to see the light. But every once in a while, a ray of light does break through the clouds. And in this case, Stephen is that glimmer of light. Someone from NZ Steel, a notoriously tough, man's man environment, that even after all these years, still finds Jim's disappearance emotionally difficult. And that's heartwarming. Stephen messaged me privately to say that a huge weight has been lifted off his shoulders that has tugged at him for almost 20 years. A feeling that he could have done more, that he should have done more, and that hopefully his contribution to this podcast can help shine more of a light on Jim and what he was going through at that time. We can understand now why Jim wanted to move far away, to Australia, to find a new job. He was desperate for a fresh start, a chance for new beginnings. How many days did Jim sit in his car in the car park before work, I wonder, in silence, steeling himself for the day to come? People that are bullied will often do one of two things. They'll either act out or they'll retreat into their shell, hiding their emotions away in an attempt to protect themselves. It takes a huge amount to stand up to bullies. And some of us don't have that in us. Some of us need someone else to stand up and say stop. But it seems that in Jim's case, he was on his own. Guilt is written, produced, and edited by me, Ryan Wolf. The title track is Nuclear Conception by Alison Winter. The opinions of guests of this podcast are just that, and are not necessarily the views of the podcast itself. You'll find further photos and videos related to this podcast on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, or our Facebook page, Brevity Studios NZ. You can discuss the case with other listeners on our Facebook group, the Guilt Podcast Discussion Group. If you want to support this podcast and help make more great content, plus get ad-free listening and bonus content, you can subscribe for the price of a coffee on Apple Plus under our Brevity Studios channel. Or for non-Apple listeners, you can now subscribe on Acast Plus. You'll find the link in the description of this episode. You can also find further information on our website, theguiltpodcast.com. If you have any information related to the disappearance of Jim Donnelly, you can contact us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. On the next episode of Guilt.
Yeah, look, he's a bit old to be suffering from a new episode of mental illness at all. So I would say, you know, that's a highly unlikely explanation for how he was behaving. He didn't seem to have any other physical health problems that might have, you know, impacted on his mental health either. So we didn't see anything like that in the materials. I think what primarily comes across is that he started behaving in a different manner in the week before. And so the question for me then is, well, why? I don't see any signs that he was suffering from paranoia or a psychotic illness or anything like that. So, you know, as I said earlier, I think it's far more likely that there's some sort of stress that's affecting him.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.